Welcome to the Living Permaculture Show on Public Radio, KDNK. This is Stephanie Sison, here with Jerome Ossentowski. Our guest today is Rob Hopkins, co-founder of the Transition Network, author of multiple books, including his new offering, From What Is to What If, Unleashing the Power of Imagination to Create the Future We Want. So I'm going to start off today's show with a little excerpt from the book. There are no cars. Everyone feels so much more relaxed. The city is so green. There are plants and trees everywhere. There are bicycles, lots of bicycles. From my window, I can see fields of crops. There are food gardens everywhere I walk. I'm walking among lots of happy children playing. The streets are full of people. I see many solar panels. There are no homeless people. There is a lot of activity. There are no big shopping centers anymore. And I hear laughter. This was a beautiful passage that Jerome really wanted to start the show with today. So I'd love to welcome Rob to the show and just offer to start out our thanks for writing such a beautiful book that's so inspiring and positive. Which is rare in the world today. It seems a lot of us are very aware of the problems that we face, and that can be sad and unencouraging sometimes. And this book is the opposite of that. So thanks, and I'm excited to share your work with our listeners today. So we appreciate being on the show. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's very kind of you to say. It was lovely to hear you reading that section of the book out, because that was actually part of people's responses from an exercise that I do where I invite people to imagine the future. So that wasn't me speaking, that was me capturing situations that people made when I asked them, invited them to imagine themselves in the future. And the thing that I was realizing the other day is that actually when I did that exercise with people, even 2 months ago, the idea, you know, people would imagine they were walking down streets with very few cars, and they could hear the bird song really loudly, and the air smelt really clean. You know, that was like, afterwards, it would be like, that was some kind of crazy fantasy, and well, will that happen? You know, you can walk out of your house where I live today, and that's what it's like, you know. You don't have to wait so long for parts of that vision to come into reality. It's already happening.
Yeah, fast forward.
2 weeks.
You said something in your book where you were talking about really this, and a lot of the book is about this idea of the imagination, but that really all we need to do is imagine this future and the things that we want in it, and somehow that opens up the possibility of it being a reality. So I was really moved by that, and I find that that's true certainly for my life as well. So Jerome has just been really excited to speak with you. And so I'll let Jerome kick it off with the first question, if you'd like, Jerome, or I can go, whatever you want.
Well, I think that the book is kind of a playbook for how we can re-envision. It's one of the playbooks of how we can re-envision our way out of this pandemic. And what do we do? You know, do we go back to the same normal, or do we do something different? And with your transition movement, you have documented on the ground and scientifically how a lot of this stuff is already happening in England and in around the world. So we need to see good examples, and you've documented those in the book. So, and a lot of us in the permaculture world are living it too. We're not completely, you know, devoid of you know, what you're talking about in the book. We're already practicing it, and a lot of other people are too. I think we should focus on what's really happening and what could be a positive way forward. And I think you can talk a little bit about that and talk about some of your experience with the transition and some of the things that have really.
Well, it's lovely to speak to you, Jerome, in person for the first time, because you know, there are many articles that I read of yours over the years in Permaculture Activist and in other places that really inspired me. So thank you for all of your great service to this movement and to the future. And I guess, you know, for me, permaculture ever since I first studied permaculture in 1992, it worked on my imagination in the most phenomenal way. For me, it kind of gave me, I always like to think of it as being like possibility glasses, that I could walk down a street and I wouldn't just see it. It's like From What Is to Cliff, you know, that was almost where that comes from, of when I did my permaculture course and I would come out afterwards and I would walk down the street and it wouldn't look just like it looks to most people. I would be seeing the gardens could go and where the vertical surfaces were and where the rainwater was coming in and, you know, where the sun was. And that was a profound kind of rewiring of my brain, really, I suppose. So this is a book fundamentally that for me is rooted in has its feet very firmly in permaculture. And the transition movement for me was always an attempt to say, how do we take those principles of permaculture and kind of design a sort of a Trojan horse that we can put permaculture in, and maybe some of Joanna Macy's work and some other things, but you can then just wheel it past everybody without having to explain what all those things are. You know, people just say, oh, it's transition town. Oh, great. Okay. And you don't have to have all those lengthy conversations about permaculture and chickens and orchards and all the arrows that join everything up. You know, you could just sort of wheel this Trojan horse past people. And this book really came about because I found myself reading lots of people who I really admire, like Bill McKibben, George Monbiot, Naomi Klein, people like that. And they kept using this term where they would say climate change is a failure of the imagination. And it got under my skin, thinking, why would we be having a failure of the imagination in 2019, 2020? Why would that be a thing? And that was really what sort of set me off on the whole thing. And it gave me a really powerful lens to look at what we've been creating in the transition movement over the last 12, 13 years, which started here in Totnes. And you'll now find transition groups in more than 50 countries around the world, in thousands of places. And fundamentally, there are lots of ways you can look at it. You can look at it as being a model for community engagement. You can look at it as a model for economic development. You can look at it as a model for kind of group process development, that kind of thing. But actually looking at it and saying it's a tool for creating what-if spaces where communities come together, ask what if, imagine a different future, and then go off and make it, felt like a really powerful way to look at what we've been doing.
The transition town, that movement, to me is something I'm really very familiar with. But as I was preparing for this call and speaking with other people and mentioning this term, I was shocked at all the people that didn't know what that was. So if there's listeners out there that have not heard this term transition towns, what is it to be a transition town, or what is this transition movement at the intro level?
Very good question. So the way I like to think about it is that transition is a movement of communities who are reimagining and rebuilding the world. So our approach from the beginning was, how do we look at climate change, resource depletion, these issues, and say, okay, what do we do about that here now with the people we have around us, with the resources we have around us? So if we used to say, you know, if I try and do it on my own, it'll be difficult. If we wait for government, it'll be too late. But if we get together with the people around us and we organize, it might just be enough and it might just be in time. Fundamental idea underpinning it all the way from the beginning was the idea of resilience. How do we design resilience into our communities so that when they encounter shock, they're able to sort of adapt to that? And at the beginning, when we started reading about resilience, people were talking about the ability to bounce back, that you encounter shock and then you can bounce back. But actually, we always said, and it feels increasingly relevant now in this time of coronavirus, and people starting to say, well, when do we get back to normal? Is in the transition movement, we always said, no, it's about not about bouncing back, it's about bouncing forward. How do we use this shock as an opportunity to bounce forward to something better, that meets our needs better, that is more, more sustainable, more resilient than what we had before? So what you see if you visit transition projects around the world is communities organizing and looking at how they grow their food, how they generate their energy, how they organize their economy, how they engage the community, various different things. but usually based on what can we do here with the resources that we have, kind of with our sleeves rolled up, getting on with things. Someone once called it hope with its sleeves rolled up, which I rather liked. Yeah, and it looks different in every place, but it kind of also has a similar feel wherever you go. It'll work in the middle of a city. It'll work in a small town. It'll work in university. It'll work in a business. It's something that'll work anywhere, really.
And it also can work in schools.
And it can also work in schools, absolutely.
You have a chapter on that, and you know, how do we imagine our education system? And I know that Stephanie has Gray in Waldorf school, and they've already reimagined their education in the Waldorf system, but that hasn't gotten through to most of the educational. But Finland has actually adopted a lot of some alternative ways of educating people, and they're considered now number one in the world as far as turning out students that can think. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I as you said at the beginning, I've written several books, and most of those books start with a chapter or with a passage about climate science. And so that I would spend a lot of my time reading climate science, reading papers so that I could write it as accurately as possible. And, you know, reading climate science is a heartbreaking way to spend your time. That chapter about the state of health of imagination in our education system today was possibly almost as heartbreaking, actually. You know, that we have created an education system which has devalued imagination to such an extent that now in lots of schools in the UK, art and anything like that is seen as kind of disposable. And particularly in the state-funded education sector, you know, there are some schools where there is no art taught at all. And it's all about getting tests and getting people through with particular qualifications. And, you know, we know that denying young people an imaginative life is really quite deeply damaging. And it's also economically ridiculous because, you know, in the UK now, something like 20% of our economy comes from what are called the creative industries, design, music, film, this kind of thing, which is more than aviation, car manufacturing, life sciences, all those things together is this creative sector. We somehow have an education system where we see that as kind of disposable. So in that part in the book, I go speak to different people all around the world who are doing kinds of approaches to education. So some of them are schools, some of them are things that go into existing schools, some of them are not schools, they are kind of places that are using the city around them as the education tool, but all of them have at their heart this idea of how do we maximize the imaginative capacity of young people. And at this particular time, I guess the key point the book makes is that this is a time where we need our collective imaginative capacity at its maximum. Our approaching a crisis where, in which, as Naomi Klein says, there are no non-radicals left.
You are listening to the Living Permaculture Show on Public Radio, Katie and Kay. We've jumped back into our conversation with Rob Hopkins. Jerome, you wanted to share a really beautiful poem that I've heard you read to many permaculture students throughout the many decades that you've been teaching them. And I'm excited for you to share with our listeners today. Can you lead us into our second half?
Yes, we like to do like a poetic interlude here, getting art back into agriculture, right? This is a poem by Vikmar Sepp, and I've actually included it in my book, Forest Garden Greenhouse book, in the pond section. Peter Bain and I were traveling in Nepal back about 25 years ago with the third permaculture conference there, and I was presenting about my first greenhouse, and we picked up this little copy of this book in a little bookstore in Kathmandu, and I think we bought 10 copies or so. They were $1 a piece, but this is the title poem from that book. It's called The Humble Administrator's Garden. A plump gold carp nudges a lily pad and shakes the raindrop off like mercury. And Mr. Wong walks around, not bad, not bad. He eyes the fragrant chamber dreamingly. He eyes the rainbow bridge. He may have got the means by somewhat dubious means, but now this is the loveliest of all gardens. And what do scruples know of beauty anyhow? The humble administrator admires a bee poised on a lotus, walks through a bamboo wood, strips half a dozen loquats off a tree, and looks around and sees that it is good. He leans against a willow with a dish and throws a dumpling to a passing fish. You know, I have a couple imagination stations here. Of course, our whole place is an imagination station, because, you know, if you're having an acre of edible landscaping, we have lots of places where you can go and sit and eat fruit, 100 varieties of fruit and berries and stuff. And then just recently, I've had hammocks in my greenhouse, but I just restrung another one. And so with the isolation, I can sit in the hammock and snuggle the cat for half an hour, an hour, and get some vitamin D and read your book and those sort of things, you know. And I think I did a lot of writing of my book when I was in the hammock that was over by the sauna. But anyway, I think that we have opportunities to go out in nature. I know everybody now is going out walking and doing a little biophilia, getting out into nature. I think that's really important, getting the size, but also getting exposed to the natural world, whether you create it in your backyard or whether you go up in the forest and access it.
Well, and what a beautiful opportunity. I'm, as I mentioned before the call, I'm out to Grand Junction at this beautiful lake, and I've been on a lot of different hiking trails over the last few weeks because the natural places are still open, and the numbers of people I'm seeing are really inspiring in places that I barely ever see anybody. There's this opportunity with other things closed where folks are getting out a little bit more. And I want to go back to what you said, Rob, about the transition towns, is that we can use these shocking times, whatever the shock is to our community, not to go back, but bounce forward. And that's in the current kind of dialogue, is this: when are we going to get back to normal? When are we going to get back to how things were? And it's really tough, but opportunity to see what we can create that's forward, that's ahead of where we were before. So I'm hopeful that will continue. And I don't know how, if you guys want to jump in and how you feel about that. But I think there's some great opportunities here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess from my side, I feel like what we've seen in the last two or three weeks is that so many things that we were told that we were completely naive to imagine were even possible, and that could never happen, all of a sudden happen really quickly. No. Sudden, you know, like in the UK, that last week the government said nobody should be sleeping rough. Everybody who's homeless should have a bed for the night. It's like, oh, really? I thought that was impossible. And that we can properly fund the things that need funding when we decide that we need to. And actually, you know, if we believed Hollywood films, and if we believed the kind of fear-mongering press, by now we should all be kind of out in the street attacking each other and going completely mad and horrendous kind of situation. Actually, what we've seen in many places has been a phenomenal reaffirmation of the power of community and people connecting and looking out for each other on their streets and serenading their neighbors with violins and, doing all kinds of extraordinary coming together stuff. And for me, the question is going to be, when people have had a couple of months of air that they can breathe and space and so on, are we really going to want to go back to that? And I think the big push for the climate movement is going to be to say, no, we push on from here. We don't let this go. This is really important. You know, we now, after weeks of having cities where the air is clean and you can walk down the middle of the road, this is precious. This is really precious. And we were told this was impossible, but hey, look, it's happened. We need to push on from this and build out. And I've been thinking about how a lot of things that we kind of pioneered in the transition movement, the argument of if we had done those things at the time, we would now be in such a different position in terms of the conversations around food resilience. What if we had ringed our towns with farms and put urban agriculture into place and seen that as part of the citywide mental health strategy and public health strategy, and we'd taken a more holistic permaculture approach to that, we would be approaching this crisis in such a different way than we are now.
Jerome and I have been in some conversations locally about what the different people and groups can do in our community during these times, and reflecting back upon starting our public food park in Basalt, and our community and our city council was really on board. But I know with talking with lots of different communities that's been a struggle to get these public places to be planted with food. And I'm very hopeful that will be a much more favorable idea these days as we try to build the world that we want to live in and reimagine what they're going to look like.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be.
So you mentioned, oh, good.
I was just going to say, the question that is really sitting with me at the moment, now that we have this really strong case for a massive rollout of urban agriculture and peri-urban farming and planning systemically for how we're going to feed our cities, the big question for me is how do we find a narrative to communicate those that appeals to people on the right? How do we find a way to make this a universal common sense strategy that we need to build that out?
Well, there are communities that potentially this can happen. It's not going to happen everywhere, but you know, when you look at some of the food systems that are falling apart now because of the coronavirus, I'll give you one example, the slaughterhouses. Now we're having major outbreaks of corona in the slaughterhouses. And the administration has actually cut back on testing of the carcasses. So you have this perfect storm for even creating more havoc and more unsafe food going into the food system, which hasn't been safe anyway, but it's now a lot. And it might even shut down because of these hotspots are happening around these slaughterhouses. I was just on a phone call with an 82-year-old soil scientist in Kearney, Nebraska. And he stayed in Grand Island. As I grew up about 60 miles from there, it's one of the hot spots in Nebraska, and it all came from the slaughterhouse. So there's another thing I saw on CNN. Up in North Dakota, there's a huge slaughterhouse that's going viral with. So how do we imagine growing our food, you know, large scale? You know, can it be grass fed? I don't know. But here's one example. Half of the rivers around the Mississippi and elsewhere in the Midwest and towards the East are infested with two invasive species of carp. There is a natural slaughterhouse right there. And now there are some efforts to set up small scale fishing industries. There's a packing house that's actually processing these things, but unfortunately they're all going to China. They're being flash frozen and sent to China because we can't, you know, we can't stoop to eat carp in the United States. Eat carp. They'll eat rubber chicken, but they won't eat carp. So this is an interesting thing. So what if we put a lot of money into this carp industry and produced all this free protein and cleaned up, and they want the fish and game already want to get the carp out. So by harvesting these commercially, and there are a lot of chefs that are already doing YouTube videos about how to eat the carp and cook it, and it's delicious. I grew up eating carp. Half the world eats carp. So something like that. So how do we, you know, we look at something that's falling apart, how do we substitute it with something that's already there and go for it? I mean, say in New York, we could be raising pigeons on all the rooftops and eating squab. You know, this is what they do in France. They have these huge barns where they raise pigeon to eat and eat them in fancy restaurants. So I know this because I grew up raising pigeon and eating pigeon and stealing them out of barns, whatever. But see, there are really some really simple solutions out there. We just have to, again, imagine them.
And Jerome, I'm going to jump in right there. We are out of time for this first episode, but stay tuned and tune in to next month's Living Permaculture Show for part two of this interview. Rob inspires us to keep dreaming, to imagine, and to create the positive future we all long for. Thanks for tuning in to the Living Permaculture Show on Public Radio, KDNK.